I call this meeting to order. It's 9 a.m. at City Hall. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Mayor Holland and Vice Mayor Nobile are excused. Councilmember Cuff?
I'm here.
Councilmember Clupas?
Present.
Councilmember Shipley?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay. Right now we're going to have public participation. Please come to the podium, state your name. We'll have 3 minutes. Seeing there are none, close public participation, and we'll move to agenda item number one, resolution approving a contract with Siege and Umbershare for stormwater drainage system improvements. Mr. Landon?
Well, with all the rain we've been having, this is kind of a timely item, to say the least. This year we actually had 3 weirs, or major crossings. One's a major crossing and a weir, 2 weirs. And because we have a grant from the Water Management District, so we're ready to get going on this, and Mike's going to give you the details.
Well, Council members, Mr. Lamb, today we're discussing that L1, K1, and W1 surface water control structures reconstruction. L1 and K1 are kind of packaged together since they're in such close proximity to each other. If you notice that north is where L1 is, with east at the top and west at the bottom. L1 is located on Sentinel Trail, and it has a watershed. They look like they're connected, but not really. L1 kind of drains in that direction there. And there's a ditch block between L1 and K1. And K1 drains like this all the way down. So it's 2 separate watersheds. They're approximately 1.5 miles apart. So we decided that we could save some money and do both of them at the same time. This is L1. If you remember, a year or so ago, we purchased 19 Sentinel Trail, so we have access to L1, and this is the time that we're going to be doing it. L1 is located at 19 Sentinel Trail, to the rear of the property there, and put a regular structure in there. This is what L1 looks like in drier conditions. It doesn't look anything like this now. It's certainly non-functional. K1 is down off September Place, similar to L1. In fact, both designs are exactly the same. One is going to be set about 1/2 foot lower than the other one, just because that's what the drainage diagram is called. September Place is in the middle of a cul-de-sac. We own that lot there. I'm not sure when we acquired that lot, sometime in the past. As far as I know, it's been city property ever since I've been in the city. And this is what K1 currently looks like in drier conditions. Right now it's pretty much underwater. And this is what they both look like when they're finished. They're both the same dimensions, width-wise, length-wise, height-wise, about a foot different, or 1/2 foot different. Now, W1 is a completely different story. W1 is across from Belterre Elementary School, or the middle school down there.
Buddy Taylor Middle School.
Buddy Taylor Middle School, that's it. And it actually is the upstream side of a bridge that runs under Belterre Parkway. They wanted to do W1 this year as a first step in reconstructing that bridge and replacing the boardwalk on the other side for next year, which will be in design this year sometime. This is what W1 currently looks like. It's concrete box covered. If you look, the normal water level is about right here. Typically, we've lowered the boards to allow water out. And what we plan on doing is replacing it with a structure similar to our water control structure, but slightly different. And this is what we plan on having it look like when it's done, where we replace the wooden stop log with we widen out the center span a little bit. We put one of our electrical and mechanical gates in the middle with a trash car to keep the trash out. Of the 35 water control structures in the city, we have 19. We have rehabilitated 19 since 2009, with 16 what we call minor control structures that don't have, it's just a regular weir, doesn't have the gate on or anything. When these three are done, we only have two left to do of these major control structures.
May I ask where those two major structures that remain are?
One's between Royal Palms Park or Royal Palms Canal and the Buddy Taylor Middle School, and the other one is down close to where K1 is set. Similar structure. They're both going to be similar to what W1 looks like. We're replacing the upstream control structure with a box in it and a gate, and K6 will have to have its pipes replaced probably with a box culvert. That's in design for this year. And P1 is some major pipes under the road that will probably end up lining. There's no way we won't jump there. Tear belt, tear over. Belt, tear properly down. This is the capital improvement plan budget showing where W1, L1, K1 are for the fiscal year 18. We received three qualified bidders. Sagan Anbach share for $807,500. They're from Deland. S.C. Klein submitted a bid of $853,868. From Palm Coast, Florida. The local bid preference was taken into account, but the maximum allowance is $20,000, so that kind of put them out of the loan. Petticoat Schmidt put a bid in of $1.2 million, and Brothers Construction put a bid in about $1.3 million. Sagan Anbach was selected as the lowest and best bidder. Sagan Anbach has done a number of projects for us, Pine Lakes Gravity Wall, Water Control Structure Bird Paradise, Colchester Drive Bridge, and they're currently fighting the weather trying to get the Colorado Drive Bridge finished.
We've had good terms with them too.
Yeah, they're an excellent contractor and they do very good work. We budgeted $385,000 for K1, L1, $385,000, W1, $220,000. Total budget was $990,000. Winning bid, $807,500, plus 10% contingency. We put the project $888,250. Of course, we have a cost share for K1 and L1 not to exceed $700,000. So we'll probably get anywhere between $618,500 to $700,000 back from St. John's.
Question on the budget. W1 is significantly less than the other two because part of that structure is going to remain.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a far more complicated one.
Well, it's no sense trying to take all that concrete out. You can just rearrange it.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to do. Expect the notice to proceed in November, December 2017. That gets all the paperwork in line so we can order the gates that take 30 to 60 days to have constructed so they'll be available on site when they mobilize in January, February sometime. Substantial completion by the St. John River Water Management District grant deadline will be 270 days at final completion. 30 days after that.
Question on schedule. I hate to be the eternal pessimist, but how long are these structures out of action during the construction process? I'm thinking what we just did through in the last month or so.
Well, especially
if we're doing two of them at the same time. That's roughly the same time.
Well, L1 doesn't hold any water for us. You know, and K1 barely holds any water. In fact, we haven't bothered doing anything with them as far as trying to keep back any water they may be able to hold. So our goal is to get those weirs as dry as possible before January. It makes it easier for the construction to proceed. And typically, when we build one of these structures, we can generally finish one in 60 to 90 days, especially if we already have the gates and everything else on hand ready to go.
Yeah. In January, hopefully, is the dry season.
Yeah,
one
would hope, yeah.
We call it the dry or wet season.
Thanks.
So this is, you all remember BS2, we finished up on Barrington Waterway. Turned out very nice. This is also a cost share program from St. John's River Water Management District. And the next step would be to approve a contract to save an Anbach share for the reconstruction of K1, L1, and W1 for the amount of $888,250. Additional questions?
Any questions?
Where does the water in the two canals, the K1 and L1 control, go?
It goes it goes across 95, and actually L1 kind of goes northeast and joins up Iroquois Waterway just past Old Kings Road.
Yeah.
And K1 goes to the Corona Canal, which kind of goes southeast towards Volusia County. Actually, it passes under a bridge that's in Volusia County. And all those canals are in the program for getting cleared out eventually.
Mike, did you have a chart you wanted to show them?
Sure. Yeah. Just to show you what some of the fancy gear is that the image. I wanted to show this chart here. This is our mission communication, and this is the transducer that measures the water level at Royal Palms Canal, just west of the fire station, the Royal Palms Canal. And if you notice here, and I can only go back so many days on this screen because it's too much data, but I can download it in a spreadsheet, so I can go back as well since we installed it. So you can see here where the water level is dropping, and then it opened the gate here, and it dropped precipitously down to this point here, which was Friday last, I believe. And then it rained a little bit, then it rained a little bit more, then it rained some more, and then the transducer went underwater. That little flat plateau there. We realize that's a design flaw that we are working to rectify. We figured that, you know, we put the motors up high enough to keep it out of the flood waters or the high waters, but we didn't think about putting the transducer up as high as the motor.
You're going to need a bigger transducer.
Oh, you see an arm for a
higher pole.
A higher pole.
Yeah.
So then the gate was left open, and the water level dropped, and this is last Friday. Went back up again.
Yeah, but it didn't go above the transducer.
Hmm?
It didn't go above the transducer.
No, it didn't go above the transducer. But then this is yesterday. And that was just less than half the rain as far as I can measure.
Actually, that had to be Sunday.
No, it was yesterday.
Yesterday? We got the rain Sunday, though, right?
Oh, it poured yesterday, too.
Oh, this is Sunday here. Saturday here. Well, it rained a little bit.
Okay.
The day before.
It poured here someplace?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was sunny out here. Yeah. I look at the chart and I go, where the heck did all that water come from?
Okay. Didn't the rain drop here to your home?
No.
Yeah. Over at where my house poured, they came back to work. Nothing.
Yeah. Well,
the frustration is doing our best. So we're going to go to the other side so fast.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the impact of. I mean, we have more rain in October already than any other year in the last 20 years, and you know, we're just getting started.
But this is great information because prior to this, we had staff gauges out. And we sense about to reach staff gauge, or just bright and sunny, everything like that. Everything's fine, 21 feet. Okay, great. We had no idea what was going on during the storm.
So one of the things we are doing right now, because of everything is saturated, is we're keeping the gates wide open. We're trying to get the canal levels lower, not just in case we get more rain, but because everything is so saturated, the water table is so high. People are getting real cranky about water in the swells, which is all over town and the ditches. Part of that is just the water table's right up on top of the ground. And so it Don't know if this is going to do a whole lot of good, but trying to keep the canal level as low as possible to get as much water out here as possible.
So is the high reading on October 2nd with the gate fully open? Or
it's fully open.
Okay.
It's been left open since September 30th. So you can see there's a little bit of rain that affects our canals tremendously right now. And mainly because all the low spots that normally would be dry are filled with water. And if it rains on the low spots that are full of water, it might as well be raining on concrete because it just runs off.
At the end of the meeting, we're going to get a little report on impact on utility too, because it's huge.
Okay, that's
cool.
It.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Okay, agenda number 2, resolution approving design construction for well field expansion.
This is actually the phase 2 of our southern well field. We are wrapping up phase 1 that included how many wells?
5.
And this one is 3 additional. We did this in phases because we pay cash, and so this just went in nicely with our cash flow. But this is wraps up the well field expansion. It includes 3 wells and then, of course, the pipe to get the raw water into the system. It's in the budget for this year for utility, and really we're ready to go. Questions?
Okay. Number 3, resolution piggybacking Clay County utility agreement with Census Metering.
This is our annual purchase of new water meters. It's Census is who we use, and we need to stay with the same meters. This is authorizing us to purchase them during the year.
Any questions? Okay, number 4, resolution information and technology purchase of supplies for fiscal year 2017-18.
You get the feeling we're at the beginning of a new fiscal year. This is just our annual allotment for IT supplies. Nothing new, it's a contracts to purchase it as needed during the year.
Any questions? Okay, number 5, resolution approving wage article with Palm Coast Laborers Union.
This is one of the most bizarre situations I've seen in my career. This is the union for our, what we call blue collar unit, both utility and public works. They have kind of interesting history with this one. One of them is that we've always proposed the same salary increase as all other employees. We've also started this year a certification pay, trying to encourage people to, once again, reward them for going that extra step, adding value and talent to the organization. Two things on this one is, the union actually proposed a wage article that was less than what the rest of the employees got. So we negotiated up. If you've ever heard of that, that was kind of a weird one. It was interesting because they, I guess, did not understand what we were offering. And then the other one was not everybody gets certification pay. You know, one thing, if your job requires that certification, and obviously it's not above and beyond. And they originally objected to that, and some of their employees have not been getting it because of their delays. They have finally decided to go along with the programs like everybody else, which is exactly what, you know, makes sense. There are about 175 employees that are represented by this unit, whether they like it or not. And 18 of them voted, and the vote was 18-0 this time. Originally, they turned down the proposal, but they voted 18-0. So we're ready to move forward and be done with it. But that's kind of the background on it.
Any questions? Okay. Resolution approving piggybacking contracts and purchase orders for fleet vehicles and equipment as approved in the fiscal year 2018 budget.
Once again, this is all of, comes out of our fleet fund. This is all the planned replacements, some new equipment for new employees and operations, all well within budget. So we're just asking you to authorize fleet purchases at your next meeting.
Do we have a price on how much the purchases are going to be?
Yes, but I have the old total bottom line. Thank you. He's going to tell me how great paper it is now. Just wait.
Where's our finance?
About 2 hours northwest.
The total is $1.9 million, almost $2 million is what we're asking for at this point. It is $155,000 under budget.
Is this are these the prices that we were talking about in our last business meeting?
Of that 1.9, about 900,000 of it was the last business meeting, and this one here is about 850,000. What we do now is at your budget hearing, ask you to approve those purchases that we know we can get the current year's prices. They lock in the prices. We'll give them PO before October 1. This is all of those that didn't have that kind of opportunity, so we're doing this afterwards.
Yeah. So this is the number for the current work order, and the
current
cover to date is the $955,000
that we
approved in the last
right. Month. And so for the total year, it's about
1.1.
And the rest of the ones we have go up for auction?
Yes, we'll usually do auction. I think there's sometimes we're able to trade in, but usually it's a public auction for the trading.
Yeah, any questions? Okay. Okay, we're all done with the agenda items. We'll now move on to public participation. Any further public comments, please come to the podium, state your name, and you will be allowed 3 minutes.
I'm not moving at this time.
Yep, Jack's getting up.
If you move, I think.
I guess you all read Mr. Canfield's remarks about the police department. Can we invite Mr. Canfield here and let him show us how he figures that we can get a police department of our own? I was reading the article and he's pretty specific about it, so why can't we just invite him over for let him explain how he can do it or what he should do it?
Thank you. Anybody else?
All right, wait a minute.
Lewis McCarthy on this same subject. You know, we went over this a couple of times about in-house policing. And there's so many ancillary things that people don't know about. You have to have a holding cell. We would have to have that. We would have to have vehicles. We don't have that. We would have to have toys for the officers. Oh, and forgot, pay. Commensurate pay. And all of these things and more come into play. By the time we're through, the amount of money that we paid the sheriff, we would blow our budget out of whack. And this is coming from a law enforcement guy. I can tell you right now, it's more to it than he thinks, because he's from the schools. And all they do is put in a budget and let it go from there. But it's a lot more involved than everything. When an officer makes an arrest, he has to go before hearings and stuff like that. Who takes his place in the street? Well, you have nobody. So it's a lot more. He's just giving you an outline that sounds good and everything is palpable. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
On the same issue, I have a great respect for Mayor Canfield and the leadership and vision that he gave to Palm Coast in our early days. However, on this issue, I disagree totally. You might want to go back and look at the history. I think it was in 2004, the city of Palm Coast hired a consultant from the International Chiefs of Police Association. I think his name was Robert Hall. And he came in and did a week-long study. His study showed that the comparable cost for officers would equal or exceed what we were then paying to the county. But the startup costs, and we just heard an allusion to that, they need headquarters, they need cars, they need guns, they need bullets, they need uniforms, they need insurance. And the list goes on and on and on and on. The startup costs would have wiped out our budget in 2004. And the startup costs today would have the same impact. The argument goes today that, well, we're being double taxed. We're paying taxes to the county to maintain the sheriff's department, and we're paying this additional money to the sheriff. Well, exactly the same thing would be the case if you had your own police department. You'd be paying all this money to your own police department, and you'd still be paying taxes to the county for the sheriff's department. I think the situation that we've got works out very well. It's almost instantaneously adjustable. If you need more coverage, you have an agreement with the sheriff that says for X amount of dollars we'll provide additional officers. You would not have that same luxury in a city. So I would urge you to continue the organization with the sheriff's department as it currently exists. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to speak? Okay. And Mr. Canfield is aware, I haven't seen the comments, but he is aware that he can come to any of our meetings and make suggestions if he would like, and we can discuss it at that point. So, thank you. Discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda, Mr. Cuff.
Other than the reports that I've sent to the media and from staff on utilities and waste pickup and so forth, I have nothing.
Same, I'm also, I think Mr. Landon alluded to earlier, that will be, yep, so that was here.
So we're all waiting for you, Mr. Landon.
Well, okay. Richard? We actually have three reports. Just so I don't lose everybody's attention, I know everybody wants to hear about debris pickup and storm impacts. But we also have a little mayor's challenge. There's opportunity for a grant, Bloomberg mayor's challenge, something that they do every year that we have actually applied for. This is one of those things where we have an issue that involves young people, and so it's great to have Maeve, who is a college graduate but an intern here, and connecting with some of our high school students. It's also an issue that our TPO is addressing, so we have professional engineers involved, and it's great to see kind of a bridge between young people who it impacts and involves and professionals get together and try to solve a little issue here that you're all very familiar with in Palm Coast. So with that little teaser, I'm going to turn it over to Maeve and let her let you know what we're applying for, and hopefully get your support today.
Thank you. So just to give a general overview, this is a grant competition that was created by a number of philanthropies to encourage cities to identify a problem within their community and then create an innovative solution to address that problem. And so the rough timeline for this competition is begins in October with the application deadline. Each city that's competing will submit an application that identifies their problem and gives their innovative solution for that problem. Between October and January, a grant committee at Bloomberg Philanthropies will choose 35 cities to move to the next phase of the testing cycle. These 35 champion cities will each receive a $100,000 grant to test their innovative solution, which will be between February and August. And then in August, each of the 35 cities will resubmit a final application that addresses some of the concerns that they may have found during the testing phase and a more detailed application that includes their full-scale implementation. And then in October, the winner will be announced, and that will be 5 cities. 4 of those cities will receive a $1 million grant to put towards their full-scale implementation, and then the 5th city will be considered the grand prize winner, and they will receive a $5 million grant to put towards their full-scale implementation. And so what we've done so far is participated in an accelerator workshop. This was run by a representative from Bloomberg who came to City Hall and met with city staff. And in that workshop, we went over the process of how to properly kind of identify a critical issue in your community, understand what that issue is, and then begin the steps towards creating potential solutions to that problem. We've also participated in webinars from Bloomberg Philanthropies. That covered, you know, general overview topics, how to identify impacts that your solution will have, and as well as the budget for the testing phase, as well as the full-scale implementation. We also had a meeting with the TPO representatives in the community problem-solving group from one of our high schools. In that meeting, we discussed the potential solutions we already come up with and kind of narrowed our solution down to the one we're using for the grant. And we've also done research again into the problem area that we've identified and the potential solutions to address that problem. And so the problem area that we discussed was conflicts from pedestrian and bicycle sharing the neighborhood roadways with vehicles. And our proposal to address that problem is the creation of a pedestrian and bicycle zone along the main neighborhood roadways. So this had the basis in a TPO suggestion that they had in one of our bike pedestrian safety studies. This would consist of restriping main neighborhood roadways to create a 4-foot zone on the road that pedestrian and bicyclists could utilize. We'd have a highly visible line that would, you know, separate the road from this pedestrian zone, and there would be reflectors along the line to increase visibility as well as create a different gradient between the road and the line for drivers. In our testing phase, we'll have pre- and post-neighborhood studies in order to collect data and survey residents, and this will also be coupled with targeted public education for drivers and pedestrians, both about, you know, the concept that we're actually implementing these pedestrian zones as well as how to properly utilize them. And so our community problem-solving group that we're working with will help us with both the surveys as well as the public education sessions.
May, let me, when we talk about major neighborhood roadways, these are the ones that are in every neighborhood that have the driveways connected to them, so the residential, but they're the ones that a lot of people use to get to their local streets. It's the park views, it's the bird of paradise, it's the rolling sands, the Eric, you know, there's every neighborhood out there has those. They're a little bit wider amount of asphalt. So the concept is to see if we can't do something with those streets. Because I know, you know, like in the E section, when I ride my bicycle on my local street, it felt comfortable. But as soon as I got on Eric, I felt like I was competing with too many cars, and it didn't feel comfortable. So it's those type of local streets that we're targeting so that we can do with those.
And that's, you know, during the accelerator workshop, one thing Bloomberg asked us to do was just get out and start talking to people. And that's really what we heard just from, you know, a few conversations, just random people walking in the park or wherever we can find them in City Hall, was that most people, if you get deeper into the neighborhood, there's less vehicles, the vehicles are generally going at a lower speed, they feel safer. if they're real close to a sidewalk or a main path along Belterre, they feel like they're safe, but it's that really that in between. So I think this isn't, it's innovative in the fact that in the U.S., this hasn't been really implemented yet, so it's an innovative idea, over the world, separation for, pedestrian zone is not something totally unique, but in the U.S. it's definitely something that's innovative, so.
And that's, supposed to be another slide of questions, so if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
This is just kind of a briefing that Nate's been working on this, and we're very excited about it. That'd be a good idea.
I think it's worth $5 million if you can get that done. I think everyone will be happy.
The strikes and reflectors cost lots of money.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Yeah.
I was just, is this the first time that Bloomberg has done this?
No, they've done this for a few years now. I think they are definitely upping their kind of marketing towards this because it seems like they've recruited a lot more cities for this initial or for this cycle of the application process. But they have done it
before and on an annual basis, and then I think some was like more of an international competition. The last time they did it in the U.S. was a few years ago, but I'm assuming we have to come up with close to probably $10 million for a full. They don't do it every year, but it's definitely a great opportunity. Even the process has been good to just think about, different ways, innovative ways. It's been very.
I was going to say, does this align with some of the past winners or their solutions? I'm just curious at what the previous competition reaped as far as ideas.
It's pretty diverse, actually. Some of them are very technology-based with apps. Others are not technology-based at all. It has to do with infrastructure. I haven't seen one that was necessarily like roadways restriping, but some was just streamlining government processes. They changed bidding processes. They changed just how you can, the public interaction between and review those processes. So it's not necessarily, kind of one size fits all. Some of them are very, very different.
And part of the accelerator workshop is really, we were one of 550 that were picked for an accelerator workshop, so we kind of made a first cut. It was really, how do you, scope a problem that you can have impact with the grant fund? So it really has to apply, to your community. What's an issue? And this is something I'm sure City Council has heard about before, so that's why the group, when I say the group, I mean problem solvers, TPO, city staff, kind of focus on this because we feel it's something that, we can make an impact, and it's something, with 100,000 we can definitely test and see if it may not, and that's part of what Bloomberg told us is it's okay. They tested ideas that end up not working, but the idea is to really bring about innovation. So it's really kind of a cool program.
The other thing is problem solvers. It's just way cool to have the high school students be there because, they're going to be part of the solution because they're lost time with the pedestrians. And so I think this whole concept of something new is exactly what they're trying to teach in the schools nowadays as to how do you solve the more real problems in a community. And so it matched up real well, and that was very... It was Maeve's idea, because she was on a problem solver group when she was in high school. And she's the one that said, boy, this sounds just like, the problem solver issue. And reached out to the high school, and they jumped on it. So just a whole good process. All right, so more, bureaucracy or storm related or whatever, not so much fun stuff. We got a couple of reports. One of them is storm debris. And as we've reported, we have been working very hard with local. You all okay over there?
Yeah. Nothing to see here.
With Irma. We've said 100 times, but it's still it's worth repeating that local resources are the only thing we have to use at this point because Irma impacted the whole state and actually beyond the state. And we are still looking for outside resources, and they are starting to loosen up. We're not getting a flat no anymore. We're hoping that we might have some of the national firms get some of their attention and resources in here this week, but we're still working hard on that. The fact of it is that people say, when are we going to get to MyStreet? What we've been putting together is a website that shows the progress we're making. But this is going to be a 2-month process. You know, just like with Matthew, it took 2 months. A lot of people don't realize. I would say that a good target date will be complete with the storm debris pickup around Thanksgiving. I know nobody likes to hear that, but it is a slow and tedious process, but we keep working hard at it. Bo's going to just go over what we've done here, but before he does that, we have WastePro has 2 claw trucks out. We have 6 crews, so we've actually keep adding crews as we can get equipment. WastePro had a truck that they did not have a crew for, so we rented the truck from them and put our crew on it. So those are kind of innovative things we're working on. We are working 6 days a week. The only reason we haven't been working Sundays is because ELS, where we take the debris, is not open on Sundays. Yesterday, we have agreed to open up the site here at US-1 we use for Matthew, because ELS has a 30 to 45 minute wait for every truck that comes in, because it's not just us, it's the county and other people are using it too. So we have a number of things we keep making adjustments on. As you've, I'm sure, well aware, your neighbors, your emails, whatever, people are getting cranky because it seems like it's been a long time, but we are putting it as many resources as we can find to get it cleaned up. And actually, compared to a lot of our neighboring communities, we're doing quite well. It is good to hear that Flagler Beach has had major cleanup, and that I actually support as being a lot higher priority than us, because there are whole households, you know, there are sheetrock and furniture and appliances and everything was out on the street. So, we were actually quite fortunate for our neighboring communities. So highlight what we've actually accomplished.
Sure. So each day on the website, we're updating this information daily. I think we're up to about 850 tons collected thus far. You'll see most of the southern part of the city has at least had, you know, first pass. The F and C's, which were hit relatively hard, WastePro has been working in. Along with, we've started in the middle of the city, and that's where, as we get additional resources, we're going to start focusing the effort to collect in that area as well. Once again, as Mr. Lane said, it's not a quick process, but I just want to make you aware there are communities that have not picked up the first pile of debris yet nearby. So the resources are slim, and we're trying to get every day is debris up in central services of how can we get more equipment, how can we get more companies and more people. We had a local landscape company contact us and have resources, and we're going to hire them to start debris collection as well. So not a day goes by that we're not trying to get additional resources to pick up debris in the city. So I just encourage everyone to be patient. Our crews are working hard to pick up debris. As Mr. Land said, hopefully I will have the temporary debris set up this weekend for if we get those additional resources that can start this week and speed up the process. So we're going to continue to work. I know folks are frustrated, but we're working our best to get it picked up.
The, if you go to our website, there is a box there that is called Debris Pickup Info, and that gives you as much information, and the map is updated every day. So we can't tell people when we're going to be there, but it is trying to let them know that they can see the progress.
It also has a list of all the streets. And then I would just add that, for Monday through, normal WastePro pickup, should be back to the normal schedule, and so encourage people if they have missed pickups or something occurs, they'll call customer service, and we'll ensure that they should be back to normal operations. And Wednesday pickup would be, you know, bags and cans throughout the city. So the piles will be, you know, through the storm that we pick up, but the bags and cans should be picked up as well.
Questions on the debris pickup?
Yeah, a couple of things and a suggestion. So we are going to be opening the site on North US 1 that we used for Matthew. Again, I know we discussed this during the business meeting. Does that present any opportunity? Is that going to be manned person staff because of the need to document the FEMA? In other words, does that do anything toward what we discussed at the last meeting of if a resident has a pickup truck or a trailer and they want to take their own pile somewhere, would that be available for that? Or?
It is manned. Yeah. Well, when it's open, while we're in operation.
Yeah.
And so we need to talk about that. But
yeah, I don't think that's a panacea, but right. I keep getting questions from residents, and I think it's a good question. I know we don't have a dump. You know, Volusia County's announced that they have places where you can take your own
right.
yard debris, but that's because they have their own dump.
Right. Have we considered that?
We'll consider that. You know, it would be manned during, you know, day, you know, sort of daylight hours.
I mean, I know we don't want everybody's freezer soaked up in there.
Give us some control to the site. So that's something we'll talk with the monitoring company, because I think that does present before, you know, we'll be taking a monitor away from managing, you know, the pickup of the trip from the pickup operation. So I think it's something, since we're going to go that route, we'll definitely consider. And, you know, I guess if it becomes an issue, then we'll have to stop it if we do go down that road, because then we can't have, you know, refrigerators and piles that are going to be chipped over there, you know, time or, so.
Probably the safest bet is if someone really wants to, we would accept it, but not advertise it as, you know, you got to dump open.
There's some, you know, just like we have the debris site button on
right.
the website, if there's something that
right.
really feels strongly about it.
That they can bring it down and we'd accept it, and we can just tell them to accept it. We'd work out something like that. Okay.
The second question, this kind of the problem sort of reminds me of the restoration of electricity, you know, right at the tail end of when that was, you know, the last few houses that needed to be hooked up. According to WastePro, they have done all bag pickups that were literally the bag and can pickups that would normally be done on Wednesdays. I know last week was supposed to be a big push to finish that up, but I know in some areas it didn't happen on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then we were going to try to do it on Saturday. I get people, I see bags and I get people asking me. That's why
I believe it was all wrapped up on Saturday, definitely not Wednesday. The goal right now is that they are on the Monday through Friday, they're on regular schedule. So if there are any debris bags out Wednesday, they should be able to get them all picked up this Wednesday. And they should have had them all picked up by Saturday. That was the goal, so they get on regular schedule. One of the keys to it is bags and cans, we don't get reimbursed from FEMA. So it's a whole different, I mean, that thing is thrown in the back of the regular packer trucks, the garbage trucks. The loose stuff we do get reimbursed, so that's one of the reasons why they're two different operations. Plus, any other, there's some small piles out there that they can toss in the back of the truck, and as soon as the bags are picked up, if they get them all done, and they still have more time in the day on Wednesday, then they'll start picking up the small stuff that they can do by hand. We also have a big pile and small pile operations. Some of the equipment, the big clogs, they don't do well with small piles, but they do well with big piles. So that truck will come by and pick up the big piles, and then we have another couple of crews that come by and pick up the small piles. So, and what happens is when the big truck dealing with the big piles leaves the neighborhood, then someone gets upset because you missed my pile. Well, it will be coming behind it. So it's really quite an operation to do it as efficiently as possible.
And I guess it's sort of a question or comment to follow up what you just said.
this is probably a forlorn hope for future situations like this, but I keep hearing, and it's been over a month now, people telling me, yeah, I finally got a tree service out to cut down that giant sycamore oak tree that broke off during the storm, and they told me that, you know, they'll cut it down and they'll put it out of the curb for X. Or if they want, if I want them to take it away, then it will be X plus whatever. I mean, obviously, if you're the homeowner, you say put it out of the curb, the city's going to pick it up for free, pardon the air quotes, at some point. Is there anything that we can think of to do as far as communications? I mean, I think in some cases you're just not going to stop it. In other cases, I think it's just true. Commercial tree services abusing our ordinances and basically offering that option to a homeowner who may not even know that they're supposed to take it away. The guys that cut it down are supposed to take it away.
The tree service people know.
Well, I just don't. I mean, that's why I say it's probably a full-on hope. But
right.
A couple of enormous piles that were left there by, and not by Joe and Andy at the chainsaw tree service, but by large commercial services out there.
Yeah, and they're from out of town, and that may be a different issue. It's a matter of they have so much business right now. If they can just cut it down, toss it on out toward the street, go to the next one, and they make more money because they're probably charging more for that tree today than they did a couple months ago, just supply and demand. Plus, if they can undercut their competition by breaking the rules, they'll do it, and then we have to deal with it. It happens to us all the time. It's rather...
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, I just, like I said, I continue to hear.
Yep, we hear it all.
Every time I think, okay, it's done, there's nothing we can do about it, I'm talking to somebody, and they say, oh, yeah, Joe's tree service told me. They could give me a break because the city would pick it up for free.
Yep. We have the same thing with the commercial.
Well, I know it happens year round, but I mean, in this case, we've got, I don't want to guess what percentage of the piles of residents are waiting for, you know, the big grapple truck to come around and pick up.
Right.
Shouldn't have been there to begin with.
And see, that's the other part of this, is that if the tree service people do their job correctly, then that actually speeds up our process too.
Well, I guess that's kind of the message. Again, probably it's a waste of time, but if there's some way we could get that message out to the community a little more clearly, maybe it'll have some impact for future storms.
Okay. And we're always working on communication. Always appreciate that feedback. Yeah.
So we always talk, especially with this situation, how it impacted all of Florida, the need for additional picker trucks, the claw trucks. Is this a situation where we have the ability to procure a claw truck, and would that one truck even make a difference? I don't know the scale of these things. If you have one truck, but you really need 20 claw trucks to make any type of impact, that one truck doesn't really do anything. But is this something that the...
We actually, which you have just approved, well, not approved, but what's coming up in the budget is one of the claw trucks would be our first one. It's not just because of storms, but we have a number of times when we have city trees, trees on city property that need to come down, and we don't really use the right equipment to deal with that. So we have in the budget in our process of buying one. We tried to see if we couldn't expedite it and get it in now, but they're not just sitting on the show floor, if you will. One truck helps. But with kind of debris we have, we do need 20. But buying 20 trucks to sit there waiting for the next storm is not feasible either. That's why you have these contracts with the national companies. But with the amount of free work that we have, it made sense for us to finally get one.
What about the commercial pickup? Has there ever been discussions with Voice Pro to have a universal commercial contractual relationship offered to our business community? And I say that because
I think during these events, obviously, a lot of people out there, a lot of explanation has to be done about why you don't put commercial debris in front of those businesses. And a few of the business owners have reached out to me to ask if that's ever been a discussion in the city to say, can we get either piggyback on contracts? Is there a way to do this? And I know with individual businesses, it's hard. You can't mandate everybody do it. But you could maybe offer an opt-in clause when we are going through negotiations.
Mayor, actually, the commercial people have multiple options, just like they do with... See, we don't provide regular trash pickup. Garbage pickup. They contract, and they can contract with WastePro, they can contract with a variety of others. There's probably about half a dozen in town. They can contract with them to do debris pickup too, or they can contract with WastePro. What the correct way to do it, in my opinion, is the people who are trimming the trees actually have the equipment, have the ability to haul it away, and they're the ones that should be hauling it away. There are a few that, you know, sweat equity is still in their veins, even if they own a business, and so they'll go out and take care of themselves or have their employees do it. And in that case, it's just a matter of contracting with, it's usually whoever is picking up their trash. But they have the ability to come pick up the debris.
I just say in light of this, I mean, you know, we always learn from these storms, if there's any way we can look to the future to say, especially on our main corridors, right? Because when you have a massive amount of debris just sitting there, not just when we're talking about drainage issues, but aesthetically, it really is a detractor from, I believe, everything we value. And I just didn't know if there was a way to sort of, as we bring in the gated communities, say maybe come up with an agreement during those time periods.
We can add it to our post-event conversation if there's some way that we can reach out to the commercial. But it would have to be something we could talk about because it would be outside our normal box. But, So why don't we add it to the post-event conversation? Those are kind of the ideas, including some of the other ideas as far as getting word out to the tree hall.
And working through our business assistance center, you know, maybe a way of connecting with all of our businesses, A, for informational purposes, but B, again, in advance of these kind of events, just to have a strategy. And I think it's worked well. It's not going to ever be perfect, but at the same time, every time we see something like this happen, it just occurs to me that there may be a way for us to be creative moving forward.
Good. And that's, I'm very proud of our team of taking these suggestions. They come up with their own, and after these events, always doing things a little different. And we did that. We learned from Matthew. You know, once again, a good thing Irma came close enough to Matthew that we remembered it very well. The bad thing is that we could remember it. So it's, but we have made changes. You know, the peptic tank was a good example, and some of the things that we did differently to try to help the PEP system recover quicker even when the power was out. So if I could use that as a segue, to ask Richard, I got to introduce this one because you get emails and someone said, well, we just had a simple rain, and that simple rain caused so many problems with flooding in the streets. Well, that simple rain was 14 inches. I mean, just think about if you national news 6 inches and they're, you know, have 3-4 feet of water in their streets. 14 inches of rain in about an 8-hour period, 24-hour period, is a lot of rain, and it definitely has a huge impact on us. The 14 inches that we got last week, I think it was a Thursday night. I've lost track of all this, but and basically what that did for our utility is it was a worse event than Irma. And we are going to have a higher recovery cost for last week's major rain
and utility than we had with Irma. A huge difference is it wasn't a declared emergency, and so FEMA won't even think about reimbursing us for right now what we're estimating to be about $500,000 just in tanker trucks. Overtime, hard to estimate right now, but it will, you know, we're working 12, 16 hour, 7 days a week. Overtime is going to be
so you could make the argument, and I understand it wasn't declared an emergency, but because of the proximity of the storm event and how it compounded that issue, that could not be an argument that we could make to FEMA?
We will definitely work on that, but unlikely. But
I would just ask the question, if we just had a 14-inch rain event, just a random, here you go, one weekend, I could not see it really creating as many issues. It would create issues, but certainly not a taxing on the system as we just witnessed.
Don't know about yesterday, but Sunday we got 2 inches, 1.5 inches.
Yeah.
That caused our tanker trucks have to come back out also. The system is so saturated, meaning the ground is so saturated, and the inflow going into the pipes, it doesn't take much rain at all to cause an impact. So let's, if we could, let Richard talk a little bit about the impact, and then we'll talk about some of the things we might be able to do with FEMA.
First of all, this has been unprecedented for this utility. We've experienced a lot of heavy rainfall events, including, like 30 inches in May and of 09. We've never experienced this kind of surcharge in our system all these years. And the nearest we can figure has to do with the saturated grounds. We had a very long stretch of dry period. We had 10 inches, roughly 10 inches of rain in July, 10 inches of rain in August, and then along comes September, where we had 23 inches of rain in September, and half of that was for Irma, only half. The other half was since Irma, and as much as 4.5 inches in one rain call event just 2 weeks ago. And keep in mind, Irma was only 1 month ago. It wasn't really all that long ago. Caused major water tables are up to the ground level. When you have a little rainfall event, 1 or 2 inches, normally that disappears very quickly. We had a little 1 inch rainfall yesterday in Pine Lakes, and the streets were flooded again. 1 inch of rain. That has to do with everything being so saturated. When things are so saturated, the sewer system takes on a lot of stormwater. The sewer system is not watertight, airtight. It's not supposed to be. But there's also a lot of various things that compound the problem. Hidden things like clean out cap in your yard that might have gotten mowed over weeks ago and it's all covered with grass. Well, when the swale's still up and gets all the way up to the road level, water goes in those clean out caps. There's probably people draining their pools into their clean out caps. There's people that have taken their gutter systems and piped them to their clean outs, to their wastewater system. So there's many, many ways on a normal basis for water to get into the sewer system. But then when, on top of that, when you flood the streets, those manhole lids are not airtight, watertight. Water goes in the manhole lids. And what happens is the lowest point in the system might be filled up. The system might be filled up and you'll see water coming out of the manhole lids. Mostly stormwater, but there is sewer mixed in with it. So, a little more about rainfall. So far in October, we've gotten almost 9 inches of rain. That's in 8 days of October. Some parts of Palm Coast got 1 to 2 inches yesterday. We talked about that. I heard you talk about that earlier. Didn't rain a drop here, but parts of Palm Coast got 1 inch, which put all the pump stations back in high level in the areas that where that had fallen. At our wastewater plant, our average flow in September was 9 million gallons a day. Our normal average is just over 5. And on September 10th, we hit our high for September was 10 million gallons. That was PERMA. Yesterday, we hit 11.6 at our wastewater plant. And on October 2nd, we hit 13 million gallons a day. That was our peak flow. So far in October, we've averaged 11.9 million gallons a day at the wastewater plant. Also, all of this extra rainfall and all the standing water has put a lot of impact on existing PEP tanks. The dirt gets very heavy when it's totally saturated with water. We're currently at about 50 tanks that need to be replaced. About 10 of them are fairly urgent, so we've cut contractors loose to go replace those tanks as quickly as possible. Most of them are just minor structural failure in the tank that doesn't put it out of service, but it definitely has to be replaced. Tank trucks, we had a fleet of tank trucks operating after Irma. It got pretty well caught up until the end of September when the rain started again. And we have been pumping around the clock since the 1st of October, September 30th. We've had as many as 18 trucks. We own 3, so the rest are contractor trucks. And that's been going on around the clock, 12-hour shifts. Our guys run our trucks and responding to work orders and PEP alarms and sewer backups and that kind of thing around the clock, working in 12-hour shifts. We've had quite a number of overflows that have been reported to the DEP, and we're pretty well caught up Saturday. We were actually doing a lot of cleanup Saturday, back trucking the swales and putting down line to disinfect, and then we got hit again. So back to running 18 trucks and responding to work orders. We've had just under 600 work orders so far this month, and 359 of those were PEP alarms. And then the rest were our overflows, backups, and that type of thing. So that's, if we get a few days without rain, we can get caught up, start sending trucks home, but until then, we're still working around the clock.
One of my responsibilities is to let the city council know when we are expending more money than the budget. So that's part of why we're doing this report, is to make sure that we're letting you know that. Obviously, we don't say, well, we don't get a budget for that much tank activity. We just go do it, and then overtime, et cetera. But also, want to stress that this is a benefit of having a very sound financial organization. Even though our emergency fund was used up by Matthew, and FEMA still hasn't reimbursed us for that activity almost a year ago, well, right at a year ago now. We do have the reserves both in our general fund operations and also utility to actually pay for this unexpected expenditures, these unexpected expenditures. So financially, this is not going to be a crisis, but it is something that we're obviously going to have to deal with here come forth. Mayor, we will try to send whatever we can to FEMA, whether that's utility, debris pickup, et cetera, our financial auditors, the people that assist us with turning all that into FEMA are here. I give the guy a hard time, so I don't like you being here, but because it's never for good reasons, but
the
experts, so we are doing everything we can.
But in Texas, this is what constrains me. So we may want to ask FEMA why Texas has already received some reimbursement. reimbursement dollars and communities. And yet here we are waiting on Matthew and our state representative can't even get an answer on why we're not getting these funds. I mean, these are critical funds, they're emergency management dollar funds, and you know, I think we need to do everything we can to demonstrate that this was a unusual circumstance that was compounded by several different events that occurred in close proximity. But Irma's, you know, really started this foundation that created a lot of these backups within our community. So, and you know, we're asking our residents to be patient and everything else, and I think it's just incumbent on us to do everything we can to send a very strong statement that, you know, we expect these funds. We're not going to wait year after year for these kind of replenishing of our budgets. So, you know, because that's another thing. I mean, we make investments in these dollars. Our emergency management fund just doesn't sit there. Reserve fund just doesn't sit there. $2.5 million just doesn't sit there.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing sort of that investment return as well with those dollars. So, there's another conversation that's fairly frustrating to me when we're looking at these numbers. I applaud the city for really taking a tremendous amount of conservative approach that allows us to be fiscally sound through these periods, but you know, it's difficult when you're dealing with an outside regulatory agency that just has no consequence to not, you know, speeding up the process.
Yes, and well said. But as you know, we and many, many others, all the way up to the governor's level, has been asking FEMA, and we're just not getting response. You know, and actually, once again, it's when you see the Harvey disaster, when you see Puerto Rico, all those, in my circles, we all go, well, we just got put back to the bottom of the pile, because that's usually what happens is when you have those really major ones, they just don't pay attention to us. Not from lack of trying, but yes, we'll keep that. One other storm-related report is that we do have one storm pipe that has basically blown out and will have to be replaced. That was unexpected. This is under Royal Palms Parkway, close to Rickenbacker. If you drive, that's between Belterre, about midway between Belterre and US 1. If you drive by there, you'll see some orange cones along the edge and a plate. The pipe has a big hole in it, so it's caving in the side of the road, etc. We have it stabilized, but being told that it's going to have to be replaced, and that was not in our plans, too. So those are things that happen with the storm, you know, and we'll just take care of it. The Stormwater Fund is the one that will struggle the most with these things, but we will get it taken care of and make things safe again. So.
Well, I want to thank you guys for doing such an extraordinary job. Really, it's not an easy feat to go through everything, and it's still...
The amount of hours, the dedication we have is very rewarding. And even if people may not see it, but you know, they're out there working around the clock right now. Then Cindy has sent me a couple of trying to get back to normal texts. This Friday we have a movie in the park here. It's supposed to start about 7:15. Hopefully it stays dry between now and then, and it's not a swamp. You know, I went to the FPC football game, and that was just a great example of the mud bath that they had there, and you could see that an area where water was still standing. It's just the water's not going anywhere. And as they put their cleats and trample on that, the water just almost coming up from underneath. It's that wet. So parks and everything, same concept. This Sunday is the Pink Army 5K, partnership with the hospital. Still time to register online. Get started Sunday morning at the hospital. I believe it's sort of the hospital. No, hospital parking lot. So those are a couple of things coming up this week. Mayor, that's all we had.
I actually skipped over anything from your chain.
No harm, no foul. We're fine.
Thank you. What was your hand?